Ladies and gentlemen, I think it's time to begin. This is session 372, entitled Mormonism in the Academy, dealing with different experiences people have had in teaching Mormon-related courses of an academic kind in regular academic settings outside of church auspices. And we have a very experienced panel here today, and I will spare you and them the time it takes to introduce them all. There's quite an extensive blurb about each one in the program. The presentations will proceed in the order in which they show in the program. I'll have a few introductory remarks in a few minutes, and then Doe Daughtry will speak on the breadth and variety of her experiences in teaching Mormon studies at different college levels with different student constituencies. She will be followed by Jana Reese, who will discuss teaching methods and classroom experiences that she's had, what worked, what didn't, and why, what worked, what didn't, and why, particularly in her teaching of Mormon studies at Columbia and Barnard. Brian Birch will discuss the pedagogical, theoretical, and curricular issues and the challenges to the critical study of comparative theology and through his experiences at Utah Valley, now University. And finally, Matthew Schmaltz will share with his with us his experiences in teaching Mormon studies at a Catholic college in Massachusetts. And where there is a kind of a certain lingering suspicion of Mormonism to start with. I would like to just make a few general observations about the situation at the Claremont Graduate University. Several years ago, six or seven or eight, the Claremont Graduate University, which is a freestanding graduate entity separate from the cluster of liberal arts colleges, that graduate university decided some years ago, as I say, six, seven or eight years ago, to create a new college of religion, and an energetic dean was hired who was looking for ways to put this new college of religion on the map. Through consultations with many people, including some of her colleagues and her own students, she envisioned and promoted an interesting model in which the principal focus of the College of Religion would be based upon the major religious traditions that are especially prominent in California. And she identified seven or eight of these. They range from the predictable, Catholic and Jewish, Muslim, to the unpredictable, which would include Mormons and Zoroastrians. So with that model, then the next step was to find community support in each of these religious traditions from which both financial and other kinds of backing could be obtained to promote this general model. In that process, one of the entities formed was the the Claremont Council on Latter-day Saint Studies or Claremont Council on Mormon Studies, which, like its sister councils for the other religious traditions, has operated as both an advisory council to the college about things Mormon, and has operated as a fundraising entity. As a result of the efforts of this council, we envision eventually a well-funded program based upon an endowment of at least $5 million. Half of that will be required to generate the interest from which the professor who occupies the new Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at Claremont will receive his or her income or salary. That half has been raised just barely, so we will have a person in the Hunter Chair starting this coming school year. This month, I guess, in fact, is when the school year starts. And so at least as far as faculty resources are concerned, we're off and running. As a member of the LDS Council during these years, I voluntarily taught a Mormon Studies course three different times, each spring semester for, I guess, three semesters. In the capacity, as I like to put it, of just trying to keep the Hunter Chair warm for the person who's really going to be occupying it, and that will be Richard Bushman. He has asked me to continue doing some of the teaching, which I will do as long as I hold out, and his dear wife and equally competent scholar Claudia will also be participating in the teaching. So we will be off to a good start. I'd like to mention that another contribution to the Claremont program was made by Brian Birch, a member of this panel, who was kind enough to devote his sabbatical last spring to teaching a course for us at Claremont. So we're reaching out and bringing in what resources we can. Many of them consist of a lot of pro bono work, but it's work in which we feel is the Lord's own work. So we're more than happy to give of our services and of our support. The Claremont model is unique at the moment. Whether the Claremont model will survive, I think, is a question that cannot yet be answered, whether for Mormon studies or any of the others. Also, whether or not the Claremont model will eventually be unique or will be replicated elsewhere cannot yet be answered. But it is an interesting model, based as it is on this outward connection with a variety of different religious communities from whom citizen support is being solicited and in part received. That citizen support for all of the religious communities will be a crucial factor in whether the Claremont model envisioned by Dean Torgerson succeeds in gaining permanency at Claremont itself, to say nothing of spreading that kind of model to other universities. Besides, the other unique thing about Claremont is that so far the courses there and the training there is only at the graduate level. The other programs of which I'm aware are undergraduate programs, though there may be some graduate courses. During the course of this session and perhaps from the Q&A afterward, you will learn about a variety of other places in which courses are being taught in Mormon studies in one form or another. I don't think that there, except for Utah State, which has the program based on the Arrington Chair of Mormon History and Culture at the undergraduate level. I think except for the Logan program and the Claremont program, there is not yet any separate entity for a Mormon studies program. There are courses, but not separate programs, especially not any based on endowed chairs. So it's a very new model. It's just beginning, and all we can do is wish it well. We will always solicit your prayers and your contributions for Claremont. With that introduction, let me turn the time over to Doe Daughtry. I've asked each of the speakers to take somewhere between 10 and 12, 13 minutes along in there, and so after that we'll have a chance for you to ask your questions. Doe, would you take over?
In the fall of 2003, I developed and began fairly regularly teaching, probably about once a year, a dedicated course on Mormonism at Arizona State University, a Research One institution. In the fall of 2006, I was also hired to develop and teach an introductory course on Mormonism for Glendale Community College in the Maricopa Community College system. And the idea was that it was an experimental course, and it would be offered through Glendale online to see how successful it was, and then would be put in the course bank so that all of the Maricopa Community Colleges would have access to it. So my plan here is to explore the distinctions between the two environments and what I see might be their consequences in my experience of teaching about Mormonism. I'm still in the process of kind of wrapping my brain around how to interpret my experience. I'm not a sociologist. I didn't, you know, like gather a whole bunch of data to try to, you know, interpret this. So these are just pretty much my comments on what I've observed. First, both of the situations differ in size, mandate, and demographics or audience. According to ASU's mission statement, quote, ASU has a vision to be a new American university, promoting excellence in its research and among its students and faculty, increasing access to its educational resources, and working with communities to positively impact social and economic development, end quote. ASU presents, quote, a new model for American higher education, an unprecedented combination of academic excellence, entrepreneurial energy, and broad access, end quote. 47,125 of its 60,000 students are undergraduates, almost 80% of whom are full-time students. 26% of ASU undergraduates are minority students. In 2006, according to the Wall Street Journal, about 3,700 of ASU's approximately 60,000 students were LDS. The university is decidedly what is being called now Mormon-friendly, making obvious efforts to cater to LDS students who are unable to attend church schools. For example, in 2004, ASU President Michael Crow made a, quote, healthy living dorm available for students willing to commit to abstaining from smoking, alcohol, and drugs. They said they tried to get, like, the sex prohibition on there, but they knew there's no way they were going to be able to enforce that one. They also swapped land with the psychology department so that the LDS Institute of Religion could build a multi-story building in its central campus location, complete with parking lot and garage. And in the spring of 2008, the institute taught 800 individual students. And indefinitely postponed during that year, 2004, indefinitely postponed a student production in the Hugh Downs School of Communication based on the author's life experiences as a gay ex-Mormon after LDS faculty strongly protested the production. And last week, ASU was listed as the number one Mormon-friendly law school behind BYU and the U of U with 75 Mormon law students. On the other hand, The community college mandate is different from that of a Research One university, and there are, to me, incomprehensible differences in funding and how they're both funded. But according to its vision statement, Glendale Community College aims to be, quote, an innovative educational provider of quality lifelong learning experiences for all members of the community, end quote. GCC demographics reflect this mandate. Okay, so I don't know if you can remember the numbers I threw out a while ago, but listen to these. Only 25% of MCCC students attend school full-time. 42% are minority students, and 39% attend school in the evening. By contrast, there are no evening statistics for ASU, right, that I could find at least. In addition, also as a reflection of the community college vision, MCCC students have enjoyed a wider range of grading options. And this has been really frustrating to me, going from the Research One University to the community college setting. Up until last semester, fall 2008, students could register for classes and receive financial aid, but drop classes with no financial penalty. Similarly, unlike students at ASU, instructors in the MCCC system have the option of giving a W or a withdrawal as a final grade. So though this was not my personal experience at Glendale Community College, anecdotal evidence that I, experienced suggests that many MCCC instructors routinely give W's to students regardless of their participation or performance because of what they see as their unique mandate and special demographics. These distinctions have implications for any class, but I have been asking myself questions about how any particular class section might be affected by these distinctions, as well as the issue of how teaching a controversial topic on the ground in the classroom differs from one taught in the increasingly online environment. I have no information about the number of LDS students at GCC, but I do know that Glendale, Arizona has a population of almost 240,000. It houses 12 LDS wards, and its students from 7 different institutes of higher learning, including ASU West and Glendale Community College, are served by an Institute of Religion in which 400 students are enrolled. Now, in developing courses on Mormonism, both of my institutions have tried to cater to both LDS and non-LDS students who are interested in exploring Mormonism through a religious studies lens, though, again, the goals of each course have had to be different. The community college course is, a 200-level course. It's an introductory course, and the ASU course is a 300 or upper division course. I have taught the ASU course both on the ground and online, while I have only taught the GCC course online. I developed the upper division ASU course around current issues. It includes historical and theological context illustrated by whatever current issues the LDS Church and its members are confronting in that moment. For instance, I would explicate a discussion of the theology behind the Proclamation on the Family with materials, for example, blog readings, NPR programs, materials from the institutional church, etc., on the church's current political activities against same-sex marriage in California. That would just be one way, I would explore that. Similarly, a discussion of church social attitudes and programs includes an exploration of whatever current humanitarian efforts the church is engaged in at the time, and news articles or other programs about the new institutional emphasis. For example, lately, if I were to do it right now, I'd be talking about food storage and the things that have come up about, worrying about shortages and, the economy and so on and so forth, and how members of the church currently are putting that into practice. Now, at Glendale, the department chair saw their course as an opportunity, with dropping enrollments in part based on anti-immigrant policymaking, to offer a course that might appeal to both students and members of the community at large. However, and of course that fits their mandate, right, to enrich all members of the community. However, despite the importance of Mormonism to Arizona history and contemporary politics and culture, the status of Arizona as a secondary Mormon market, and the growth of Mormonism in the world, course approval involved with the Board of Regents involved a long and complicated struggle to justify the existence of the course in the community college system. I do not claim to understand what the process was, like, or what it was all about, but unlike my experience at ASU, where I was simply given the assignment to create the course and given free rein and just let go, the community college system in Arizona has an intricate process by which even experimental courses are approved. All along the way, some community members expressed concern that the course was perhaps inappropriate for the system, in part because it singles out a Christian religion for special attention. For example, there are no dedicated courses taught about Quakers or Baptists, or even, you know, Roman Catholics. And so that was an issue of concern. What are we going to do when the phones start ringing and people want to know why we're not teaching about their tradition? But I would suspect that there was likely also concern over the extent to which the course might somehow be perceived to skirt difficult or controversial issues in Mormonism. In any case, the GCC course was approved, and I've taught it twice, and I will be teaching it again in fall 2009 as a regularized course. So it will be, you know, it will be a permanent course in the MCCC course bank. The course I developed for this system, then, is introductory in a different way. It requires less critical analysis and less advanced reading and exploration. It's a fundamental course concerning the history, scriptures, doctrines, and organization of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as a modern American religious movement. That's the course description. And, like the ASU course, it has no prerequisites. For both courses, I had started using Terrell Gibbons' book, The Latter-day Saint Experience in America, one in a series of high school to undergraduate level readers on religion in America. And they're really excellent. There's one on Buddhism, you know, the Buddhist experience in America, the new religious movement's experience in America, which I've also used for one of my courses. It does a good job of introducing both the study of religion and Mormonism to those who are likely not to have any background. At ASU, I complicate the text with supplementary materials, less so at GCC. The community college course competencies are, one, to identify and assess approaches to religious diversity within the context of encounter with religious others and new religious movements. Two, examine the development of Mormonism throughout North America. Three, recall the origins and nature of the basic Mormon scriptures. Four, identify and explain the core religious practices of Mormonism. Five, outline Mormon worship and organization. Six, describe Mormon perspectives on various ethical and social issues. Seven, examine the historical crisis of division and the relationship of modern fundamentalist offshoot groups to mainstream Mormonism. And eight, evaluate the debate over the question of Mormonism's status as a world religion. And now these competencies come right out of that textbook, right? So, just for your information. The distinctions I've seen between the students in the two locations likely have something to do with demographics, but I'm not prepared to reduce those distinctions to class, race, ethnicity, or family and work commitments. And I have not collected, as I said, sociological data for such an effort. I simply offer these demographics and my observations as a way by which to point to what I see is different in the student populations and institutional mandates. On a good day, religion is difficult to discuss academically when one has strong exclusivist religious commitments. So I always expect to have to teach students how to have that conversation. However, ASU students who are non-religious studies majors appear to be more prepared to have the religious studies conversation with less stress. Whether online or in the classroom, they show up and they seem more able to suspend their allegiances to explore the messiness of their religion and religion in general. Similarly, non-LDS students who might be antagonistic to Mormonism seem to have had the types of experiences at ASU to enable them to intuit what kind of discussion is really appropriate for the religious studies classroom and take instruction well when their intuition is off. In contrast, my LDS community college students have been more likely to approach the Mormonism course as an institute course. Their approach is more likely to be uncritical, their expectation of what should be the nature of a basic or introductory course. This indicates to me that they are more likely committed to gathering information than enhancing their critical thinking. This is not an aspect of the community college mandate, but it has been my experience with many of the LDS community college students. Perhaps this is because the course is not only an elective, but it's something they report they are doing just for fun. To learn or to learn more about their Mormon heritage. In other words, I think they know it all. It's an easy A. I've actually had a student tell me that. In relation to the issue of withdrawals, LDS students have been, in my experience, more likely than non-LDS students in these courses, in the community college course, to drop out when they're challenged by course content. And many of them fail to take the course seriously or stop participating when they get upset without dropping, simply because the system allows them to. I had one student who said he would no longer participate because his institute's courses were more important to him. He didn't drop, but after three quarters of a semester of absence, he took the online final, which he then failed. Then he insisted he still wanted a W. When I asked him why, if he had wanted a W, he had taken the final exam, a gesture I thought indicated just the opposite. like, what's wrong with me? His response was that he just wanted to see what, you know, how well he could do, having not paid any attention or read any of the materials. Nothing like that has ever happened to me at ASU. In addition, while the ASU course has grown in students, especially when I have taught it online, the GCC course, even though it is an online course, has generated very little interest. I had 8 students the first time I taught it. I mean, after everybody had dropped, you know, that didn't want to be there, and like 7 or 8 or 9 the second time. The numbers simply did not materialize, I suspect because the Mormon mothers and other LDS Latter-day Saints in the community, who were in part a large portion of the course's target audience, already know the basics of their religion and would not pay a secular institution to teach them something they could presumably enhance through Sunday school and or institute classes. Similarly, LDS students at GCC appear to me mostly committed to the Institute of Religion for their education about Mormonism. Thus, while my LDS students at ASU appear to expect their assumptions to be challenged, their community college peers appear more likely to expect the conversation to support their faith journeys. This is exacerbated by the complex challenge of the community college mandate, in my opinion. All of this is complicated also by the online environment. My observation is that students who would simply know better in a classroom are more likely to say all kinds of inappropriate and wild things online. Discussion forums online require students who would never speak in class to interact and share their ideas. And the discussion is incredibly rich. I mean, you get something controversial happening, it's just fantastic. But in a classroom, when I ask, why are you here, what do you know about Mormonism, what don't you know, and what would you like to learn, I get all kinds of interesting answers, and people seem to know what's appropriate to, you know, what an appropriate response is. But LDS community college students are more likely to answer online by bearing their testimonies. Last semester, several LDS students responded to that question with some version of, I know the LDS Church is true, that Joseph Smith was a prophet and that Gordon B. Hinckley is a prophet today. So I talked to everyone about it. Some of them are unable to make that shift, and some of them stopped participating, again expecting me to offer them a W at the end of the semester. Similarly, when I give them a series of questions for observing general conference, my LDS community college students are less likely than their ASU peers to be able to suspend their habitual ways of listening and seeing to analyze what really happens when Mormons from all over the country / world gather together for this event. For instance, I ask them to note in their chart who speaks, what they speak about, how long they speak, the extent to which women and children either participate or are the subjects of talks. LDS community college students are more likely to simply ignore the question as if I hadn't asked it and observe that women are really important in Mormonism and then give information about Relief Society, Young Women's, and other organizations to prove their points. Having made my disclaimer about demographics, I think they may point, however, to an important disparity in terms of access and familiarity with the online environment. I routinely teach on-the-ground courses at ASU that are highly mediated. When I took on a last-minute on-the-ground world religions course at the community college level, I found that students were thrown by that high level of mediation, and I was wrong to assume that they had the capacity to take online quizzes and be responsible for the online materials I had assigned. I routinely got comments like, well, I don't have a computer. I mean, that's the reason that they're taking classes on the ground. They don't have a computer, whereas at ASU, there is this expectation that if you're at ASU, you will have access to a computer, either on, you know, on campus. And yes, GCC has, you know, computers on campus, but because of the demographics and what they're doing, what's happening to them in their lives, they may only be at GCC that 1.5 hours for their class. And so I was wrong to assume that they had the capacity or the ability to do what I, you know, to look at the online materials I had assigned or whatever, you know, take the online quizzes. So I have responded by taking a hard look at my motives for how I'm teaching, asking myself what I intend to accomplish by asking them particular questions. Usually I feel okay if I can point to the fact that I'm illustrating or explicating the text, though I do have to say that only the community college, the LDS community college students, have accused Carol Givens of being anti-Mormon. In addition, I have examined and revised course requirements and assignments. I am deeply committed to both the community college and the university mandates, and I am also committed to being present to help all students learn to be responsible for their own educations. I am also committed to figuring out ways to convince students that looking at Mormonism from various perspectives can enrich their lives, whether or not it is their faith life. I am, however, frustrated that I have been unable to reach across cyberspace and engage the community college students in the same ways I've been able to do at ASU. Admittedly, my ASU Mormonism course online suffers from some of the same issues in relation to controversy that I've experienced in the community college. However, the expectations students bring into the course are more mature despite their relative demographic youth and are more easily resolved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in one of those, you know, Mormon bingo small world experiences, this was my very first visiting teacher in the church.
I thought you were my visiting teacher.
Well, anyway, visiting teaching was accomplished in our relationship. So we go back a long time. Brian is handing out a syllabus from a course I actually taught, and also a syllabus from a hypothetical course that I would someday like to teach if I had the opportunity to do it again. I'm going to talk about some of the decisions that I would make today. With the mini explosion of Mormon studies in the last decade, Mormonism's inclusion in the curriculum has progressed accordingly. What began with a brief overview in American religion classes morphed into introductory survey courses in Mormon studies and then scaled the heights to the ultimate in undergraduate education, which is the seminar. As more colleges and universities are now allowing for small, more advanced classes on Mormonism in the way that they have in the past for more established religions, some particular challenges and opportunities have arisen in the classroom. And I'm going to not speak on a macro scale about what's going on in Mormon studies, so much as to address on a micro level my own experience in teaching such a class and my reflections on the state of Mormon historiography right now. In 1997, I taught my first seminar entitled Mormonism in America. It was a 300-level course at Barnard College, Columbia University, where I was doing my own PhD. Most of the students were undergraduates with a few graduate students and auditors sprinkled in. And in looking over the old syllabus, which if you'll see, they look the same at the top, but it says fall 1997, I am perfectly astonished by what has happened in the Mormon historiography in the last decade. I've taken the liberty of revising the syllabus for a hypothetical seminar the way I would teach it today, and you'll see that few of the books that were on the first syllabus and the required reading list survived the test of time to be assigned again. For example, we lost Nathan Hatch's Democratization of American Christianity, as well as Jan Schiff's foundational book, Mormonism, the Story of a New Religious Tradition, which is still listed in the new syllabus as a supplementary text for student reports. In some cases, the changes came about simply because students failed to respond enthusiastically to the earlier readings, or perhaps better options have come along on those topics in the intervening years. In other cases, it's just because I omitted some very important topics the first time around. I've since realized, perhaps reflecting my own bias as a historian, that we covered Mormon history pretty accurately and thoroughly, I think, but I did not give the students enough of a grounding in Mormon theology and belief. In particular, when I look at the old syllabus now, I am chagrined by the utter lack of any attention paid to the Book of Mormon or to basic Mormon ideas about God. And so you'll notice that in the revised syllabus, I've actually assigned one of my own books, which is, you know, one of those wonderful little chestnuts that professors do. This is called The Book of Mormon Selections Annotated and Explained. and I wrote this for a Jewish press a few years ago. It contains approximately 10% of the Book of Mormon. It is basically war-free. So if you're looking for your war-free Book of Mormon, this is it. The publisher wanted to have basically the highlights of the Book of Mormon, and what I realized in the process of doing this text was that it is almost impossible to divorce the Book of Mormon from its narrative context. So the book, in that sense, is a failure, but I do think that in the sense of introducing people to the Book of Mormon for the first time and highlighting some of the theological themes, it's important and it's good. So I have one free copy here. Whoever gets to it first gets to take it home.
Oh, I'm here.
Okay, well, she has a geographical advantage, so she might get there first.
No, I have a copy.
Okay. So you see, I've added a week on early Mormon theology and the use of scripture. And the second syllabus retains some earlier emphases on gender, on race, but this time I would also add a week on international expansion because I think that's an important and a growing topic. I structured the seminar so that each week the whole group would read one book together to discuss as a class. Twice during the semester, each student would also have to do a written and oral report on another book from the supplementary reading list. And this added to the class's overall understanding of the period and of the topic of the week. Sometimes the reactions to these books were far more passionate than I would have expected. Early in the term, a student named Jennifer read the book Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism with the entire class. Now, this was the early U of I edition of Richard Bushman's biography of Joseph Smith. And for that same week, she had also chosen to do a report on Valene Avery and Linda King Newell's biography of Emma Smith. And Jen told us that as she was reading the Bushman biography, she found herself thinking very sympathetically about the whole Mormon project. Maybe it really is plausible to have a prophet today. Maybe the Book of Mormon isn't just an outright fabrication. And then she read the Emma Smith biography and saw many of the same events through an entirely different lens, and she said she realized that this was a guy who lied to his wife and was basically a sex addict. She concluded that he was a pious fraud. And from this, we as a class had a very interesting discussion about sources and about how an author's own beliefs and prejudices might shape a reader's reaction to characters and events in history. From this and from other experience, I recommend, for those of you who may be teaching such a course, one technique is to assign very different, even opposing, perspectives in the same week, just to see how the students will react. I found that it was useful to begin having this conversation really early in the semester because the issue kept coming up. At that time, Mormon literature was highly polarized. I think it is slightly less so today. With apologetic works defending Mormonism on the one hand and detracting voices seeking to dislodge Mormon claims of truth on the other, and very little good work in the middle. Hopefully, I do believe that is changing. The issue of bias cropped up again late in the semester when we spent a week on the tropes of anti-Mormon literature, and you'll see that this is one of the topics that has been cut from the new syllabus because it just didn't seem as important today as it did at that time when, entirely by coincidence, I was writing a dissertation on that topic. My brightest and most wonderful student, who is now a lawyer, challenged me after reading Deborah Lake's expose, Secret Ceremonies, which some of you may remember was a moderate bestseller in the 1990s that chronicled a modern woman's disaffection with Mormonism, with her marriage, and especially with the LDS temple. I had thought it obvious that this book, which seemed to go out of its way to shock and denigrate, could rightly be classified alongside 19th century anti-Mormon literature in much the same way that the ex-polygamist's wives' versions of the captivity narrative had, you know, similar ideas and tropes. My student disagreed, arguing that this was a valid memoir whose criticisms should not be dismissed outright simply because the author had an axe to grind. The author's bias, Meredith insisted, did not nullify the legitimacy of her criticisms, however they may be packaged. I was put in the uncomfortable position of realizing that in spite of all my beliefs in my own objectivity, my own tolerance of criticism of my religion, I was as vulnerable as anyone to a knee-jerk reaction. It was a valuable lesson for me. I discovered that religious location became apparent in our small group in a way that it never had when I had taught Mormonism as part of a lecture-based survey course. Our class was split right down the middle between Mormon students, some of whom were active, some of whom were not, and interested non-Mormons and religion majors. This proved to be an ideal balance, and it happened entirely by accident. I would suggest that professors be very careful about outside auditors who are interested in taking courses about Mormonism, and this kind of echoes what Doe was saying a minute ago. Somehow, when I was teaching this seminar, word got out into the Manhattan student ward that Columbia was offering a seminar on Mormonism, and we had a very high turnout the very first evening. I was not strict enough about my requirements for auditors, never having taught a seminar before, and not realizing the importance of creating a small, committed, stable group of students. For those first few weeks, I'm embarrassed to admit that we had auditors kind of drifting in and out of discussions, sometimes without even having done the reading. I soon became far more draconian about my expectations. I also discovered that a couple of the auditors who dropped out were Mormons who were initially interested in an academic study of their faith, but then felt threatened when they realized that the course was not an institute course, and that it would be leveling serious questions toward the institutional church or the party line about Mormon history. Early on, we discussed the several different versions of Joseph Smith's first vision, and the fact that with each telling of the story, the events became grander and the protagonist younger than in the version before. And the following week, a medical student who had been auditing the course had vanished as surely as the three Nephites. In some ways, I do think that this kind of winnowing is normal, and it's not actually all that different from other religious students' experiences in studying their faith from an academic perspective, perhaps for the first time. What I would say is that my students found it very helpful to weigh texts against each other, as I described earlier, and to learn how to ferret out bias on both sides. Basically, they had to learn to think critically about sources. I don't think I had any Mormon students who were able to think critically only about non-Mormon sources and myopically about pro-Mormon sources, but I have heard from other teachers that this is sometimes the case. Now, in our class, a huge part of the course revolved around the students conducting their own primary research into a topic of their choosing and preparing a 20 to 25 page paper on that topic. I was deeply impressed by these papers, at least two of which could easily have been published. Maybe we can get them for dialogue still. Several of these were about historical topics, including some of the wives of early Mormon settlers and that sort of thing. One was a contemporary oral history, where a student went around New York and New Jersey interviewing the wives of current and former stake presidents about being a woman in the LDS church with a husband who was absent much of the time. As the teacher, I had to help the students who were doing contemporary topics find interview subjects who would be willing to talk candidly about their experiences. And for the students who did historical topics, I saw that a large part of my job was getting them access to the primary sources they needed. When I taught this course, I was living in Princeton, New Jersey, and had access to Firestone Library, which has the most extensive collection of Mormon holdings that side of the Mississippi. And so I helped them sneak into the Firestone Library on Saturdays. And, you know, this was entirely illegal and probably wrong, but I did it anyway. Columbia's holdings were absolutely terrible in Mormonism, and it was important to me that my students have access to the very best that was out there. And nowadays, that would be far less of an issue. So many of those texts are available now online. Also, some of the articles are available in Dialogue. And I brought some of these DVDs that are available for free to any of you, and Dialogue Foundation has made it a priority to make these available for free to any student taking a Mormon Studies course. You just need to identify yourself by calling the office. And I hope that I have the opportunity to teach my hypothetical course as reality. One thing I wanted to say about the Mountain Meadows Massacre book, because that's what everyone's talking about here, it's not on my syllabus except as a supplementary reading. and that was intentional. I think that the book is a very good history. I have no qualms on that. But one thing we always need to remember in teaching is what will grab the student. And there's, as speaking as an editor, it's just not that compelling as reading. And I want my students to have stories. I want them to know story. And to me, Juanita Brooks' book still stands as the best story. Thanks.
As one surveys the emerging field of Mormon studies, theological studies stands out as among the least developed. The vast majority of published work in this area for the past 30-plus years involves either A, homiletic expositions that broadly fall within the category of scriptural theology, or B, academic publications that are almost exclusively apologetic or devotional in nature. These have largely been the work of leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Excuse me, I lost my place here. Or educators employed by the Church at either Brigham Young University or as part of the wider church educational system. The dramatic growth and public visibility of Mormonism, however, has prompted an interest in its distinctive theology. This has in turn created opportunities for Latter-day Saint thinkers, along with interested onlookers and critics, to more carefully reflect on Mormon doctrine. Though the community of scholars working on these questions has been relatively small, there is recognizable movement. And some of you are aware of the recent formation of the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology, with its journal Element. Publications of the past 5 or 6 years include Terrell Givens' By the Hand of Mormon, David Paulson's and Donald Musser's Mormonism in Dialogue with Contemporary Christian Theologies, Robert Millett's Another Jesus, The Christ of the Latter-day Saints, and How Wide the Divide, A Mormon and an Evangelical in Conversation. These and other factors led me to develop a course entitled Mormonism and Christian Theology, which was offered for the first time in 2006 at Utah Valley University and was then developed into a graduate seminar for Claremont Graduate University, where I had the wonderful opportunity to teach this past spring while on sabbatical at Utah Valley, as Armand mentioned earlier. In addition, Richard Bushman will offer a class at Claremont this fall entitled The Mormon Theological Experience, which deals with more historical issues and figures than my class did, which was much more contemporary. In the remaining few minutes here, though, I want to turn my attention to some broader questions in thinking about teaching on Mormon theology and related topics. During a 1998 conference on interfaith dialogue, Patrick Horn, one of the Southern Baptist participants, recited the popular adage that when you have two Baptists in a room, you're likely to have three theological opinions. And in response to this, Jim Faulkner, the Latter-day Saint representative, replied that when you have two Latter-day Saints in a room, you're likely to have no theological opinions. Now, there is certainly something right about this, and some have responded to the formation of a course in Mormon theology as being suspect, if not altogether inappropriate. But what kind of a claim is it to say that Latter-day Saints don't do theology or don't have a theology? Is this a descriptive or a normative claim? Is the claim itself a theological one? And finally, and perhaps most importantly, what are the implications of this position for the academic study of Mormonism? These questions seem ripe for further discussion. It is certainly clear that from its beginnings, Mormonism has had an uncomfortable relationship with theology, and resistance to theological questions has been persistent and strong. This is understandable given the cultural setting of early Mormonism, which shared common features with other Christian Restoration movements, most of which began with strong critiques of theological speculation. While other movements eventually incorporated theological influence, Latter-day Saints have, with notable exceptions, resisted this move. Though a complicated story, the following features stand out in LDS resistance to theology. First, there is the doctrine of continuing revelation through prophets and apostles. Second, the emphasis on personal religious experience over doctrinal formulation. Three, a completely lay ministry with no formal training in theology. And four, the rejection of the traditional creeds as manifestations of an apostasy. As the largest religiously sponsored university in the nation, Brigham Young University has a large faculty in religious education and has committed substantial resources to the study of Latter-day Saint history and projects in ancient Near Eastern studies. The newly formed Maxwell Institute for Latter-day Saint Scholarship is an impressive organization that supports numerous influential projects in the study of Mormonism. And yet, despite its size and influence, BYU has conscientiously avoided substantial support for theological studies. Very few professors have academic training in theology or religious studies, despite having a very large department of church history and doctrine. Though Latter-day Saints embrace reason as a necessary tool in the acquisition of truth, the authority of reason is commonly said to apply only to those truths that are consistent with the authoritative teachings of the church. And this is where the talk of theology enters. To the extent that reason is extended beyond the limits of the revealed teachings of the church, in the interest of a systematic account of Mormon doctrine, reason is said to become hubristic and possibly idolatrous, with the danger of arrogating one's own abilities beyond the prophetic office and of the leaders of the church. Hence, speculation is strongly discouraged in favor of reflection upon what is said to be already known on the basis of revelation. As Gerald Bradford puts it in his article on Doing Theology, quote, "Why not prepare a carefully comparative study of important scriptural and prophetic words and phrases to enable us to better understand this mode of expression?" End of quote. This description is characteristic of the language of contemporary Latter-day Saint scholars in understanding the appropriate application of reason to scripture and doctrine. This approach accounts for the publications that describe themselves as expositions or doctrinal commentaries, with careful avoidance of the term theology or philosophy. This is not to say that these scholars reject reason in expressing scriptural or prophetic teachings. In fact, Bradford states later in the same article that the right kind of theologian is, quote, required to present his ideas in a clear and coherent manner. His reflections must be carried out in a consistent and systematic fashion. His arguments must be valid according to the rules of logic as any other scholarly discipline. The emphasis would be on theological clarification, not on theological system building or speculation. End quote. But herein lies the rub for me. I would argue that this apparently humble language of exposition and explication is really not so humble. For it runs the risk as well of masking speculative theological arguments in the guise of mere clarification. The absence of traditional theological vocabulary does not mean that speculative theological work is not being done. The theological work being done here is more implicit, but these implications may be every bit as dramatic and potentially misguided as that of the speculative theologian decried in much of the literature. This isn't intended in any way to be a defense of speculative theology, but more as an attempt to call into question the way in which it is categorized. Finally, if one accepts that the most appropriate introductions to Mormon thought are those limited to doctrinal expositions that fall within the scope of church-approved publications, then one has accepted an ecclesiastical criterion for what counts as Mormon theology, rather than the tradition-based approach, which is more appropriate to the religious studies enterprise. And a couple of examples are in order, and then I'll close up. One is from Stephen Robinson's book, Are Mormons Christian? He tells the story of when he was asked to teach a class on Roman Catholic theology. And he expressed how careful he was to only choose texts that had the stamp of Neil Obstat, which is a technical classification within Roman Catholic thought that basically is translated as without objection. So Robinson's criterion was that if the Roman Catholic Church did not accept the text without objection, then it was inappropriate for an introductory class in Roman Catholic thought. So what's interesting about this for our purposes is that Robinson has accepted the same ecclesiastical criterion for what counts as Roman Catholic thought, rather than the broader scope that would include works from the boundaries of Catholic orthodoxy, such as Hans Kuhn or Leonardo Boff, to name a couple. Another anecdote that's interesting is halfway through this semester at Claremont this year, I had lunch with one of the members of the Council for Mormon Studies. And at one point in the conversation, he had expressed some misgivings about the way in which I was approaching the curriculum because he had been sitting in from time to time on my class. And in exploring more what his hesitations were, he expressed concern that the non-LDS students in the class were not getting what he called something like the straight scoop. And upon further discussion and reflection, what it appeared that he wanted from me was to first teach the gospel principles version of Mormon doctrine, and then to proceed to the more interesting boundary issues and speculative work. Now again, this approach presumes this ecclesiastical criterion for what counts as Mormon thought, rather than a more secular, again, tradition-based approach that someone in religious studies would follow. And so I think these questions are very much in play when one thinks about teaching Mormon thought, whether one devotes an entire semester or a section of a class like Doe's or Janet's. So questions that emerge here are, to what extent are scholars of Mormonism ethically or professionally required to offer the contemporary LDS narrative of itself as it is expressed in its correlated curriculum? Obviously, this narrative is a very important part of Mormon theology and should be an important part of the classroom, but should it have any bearing at all on curriculum and pedagogy? At one level, the answer is obviously not, but the way in which Mormon doctrine is configured in the secular classroom is naturally contentious and has implications for the way in which the church is presented to those who otherwise aren't introduced or exposed to Mormonism. Thank you.
When I first met Armin today, he told me that, number one, I was overdressed, and number two, because of that, I guess, I look like a Mormon. So, you know, I'm glad that I look appropriate for the topic. The title of my paper is Teaching Mormonism at a General Jesuit Liberal Arts College, Round 2. And the reason why it's Round 2 is because about 3 years ago at a Sunstone conference, I talked about Round 1. And so my first efforts to teach Mormonism at the Jesuit college where I teach. And so this is a reflection on that and what went right and what didn't go so right. I happen to be a South Asianist by training. That is, I primarily study Hinduism and also Roman Catholicism in India. But I've long maintained an academic interest in American religiosity, and certainly there's no religion that is more American than that of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who are still most commonly referred to as Mormons, at least by Catholic Gentiles such as myself. And so I've been rather quietly teaching Mormonism and as part of a larger course in modern religious movements at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. College of the Holy Cross is an exclusively liberal arts school, has an enrollment of 2,700 students, and was established in the 1840s. And so I'd been teaching Mormonism as part of a modern religious movements course for several years, when in September I got an email from someone named Paul Rawley, a columnist at the Salt Lake City Tribune. And evidently he had learned that, quote-unquote, the folks at Zarahemla Books, close quote, a Mormon publishing group in Provo, were a little surprised to get a book order for my class for 30 copies of the supernatural thriller Brother Brigham by D. Michael Martindale. And so in an email, I explained to Paul, we got on a first-name basis pretty quickly, that I was interested in teaching the diversity of Mormon culture, and one way to access that is through fiction, particularly the kind that pushes beyond the G-rated ceiling that bounds most LDS fiction. And so when Rawley published his column in the Tribune, I got a call then from KSL News Radio here in Salt Lake, inquiring initially why I would present Mormonism through a single fictional book. Okay, so the impression was it was like I was teaching Catholicism through some sort of supernatural thriller or something like that, you know? Yeah, or Dan Brown book, one of my classmates. So in any case, when I explained that the course had more than one text, and some texts were part of the Mormon canon, the questioning turned to whether it was appropriate that I was teaching Mormonism alongside the Watchtower, Branch Davidians, and the Church of Scientology. And so no sooner had I finished this discussion than my office phone rang again. And I answered, and it was berated, and I mean really berated, by a self-described Utah Catholic who thought it was unseemly that I was presenting Mormonism in a positive light at a Catholic institution. And so several days later, my phone rang once again in my office, and I was thinking, well, I got to get caller ID. You know, this is really getting out of control. And this time, it was an editor from an arts and literature magazine in southern Utah. And so he was doing a story on Zarahemla Books, and the journalist seemed particularly concerned with encouraging me to use different LDS authors, particularly Orson Scott Card. And so I thought, gee, you know, I just can't do anything right. You know, I got everyone angry at me and so forth. But later on, when I did publish an article about Mormonism, I got very, very nice emails from people from farms and fairs. So I guess I'm doing okay with the Orthodox crowd. So these comments brought into sharp relief some of the text taboos and tussles that I've encountered and experienced in my pedagogical engagements with the LDS tradition. And as you all know, the teaching of Mormonism used to be confined to a scholarly cul-de-sac within American studies. And that has now changed, as you've heard, particularly with the candidacy of Mitt Romney, a former governor of Massachusetts, bringing Mormonism into the American mainstream. There has been a concomitant interest in Mormonism as a religion. But in many academic contexts, considering the LDS tradition as a religion in its own right invites a defensive reaction. Since Mormonism is a young religion, depending upon your perspective, it's often perceived to lack the requisite gravitas associated with older traditions. Moreover, at least when it comes to students, caricatures of Mormonism abound, ranging from images of a polygamous cult to peculiar and vague notions of a well-to-do community out west that celebrates domesticity and patriarchy. I encountered suspicions of Mormonism in an unexpected way at my home institution, the College of the Holy Cross. And as I said before, I was teaching Mormonism as part of a course entitled Modern Religious Movements. And for many of my students, interestingly enough, Mormonism was hardly alien. Some had Mormon friends in high school, and many had encountered Mormon missionaries. But their suspicions of Mormonism deepened as the course developed, oddly enough, through reading Richard Bushman's historically substantive but quite sympathetic portrayal of Joseph Smith, something that Jana was talking about. And so when I concluded the course with a discussion of John Krakauer's Under the Banner of Heaven, I intended it as an example of what I would call cult discourse or anti-Mormon discourse. And in initial iterations of the course, this is exactly how students perceived it. But when set against Bushman's portrayal of Joseph Smith, many students found Krakauer's suspicion of Smith and Mormonism more credible. In the end, while I wanted to examine Mormonism as a religion, the course became a referendum on the sincerity of the Mormon prophet. So in round two of structuring the course, I decided to foreground suspicions about Mormonism. But in so doing, I hoped to move beyond concerns of evaluative judgment in order to engage Mormonism as a religion, and a diverse one, in its own right. So please hold your criticism until the end. But the foundational text I chose was Fawn Brodie's No Man Knows My History. And so when I first started teaching Mormonism, I chose Brodie's work simply because, to coin a phrase, I myself knew no other history. And as, of course, I learned more about Mormonism, Brodie's attitude toward Joseph Smith seemed very, very dated, to put it mildly. But in spite of this, Brodie's work does have the singular merit of presenting an accessible narrative that places Joseph Smith in his immediate historical context. And accordingly, Brodie's use of what in anthropological terms would be called thick description provided a good foundation for learning about the prophecies that shape Mormonism as a religion. And so along with the historical narrative, the course initially considered prophecies related to specific historical events, such as the admonition to Martin Harris to, quote-unquote, pay the printer's debt, and then moved to prophecies with broader import, such as Smith's vision of a tripartite afterlife. Proceeding this manner allowed students to discuss questions of Joseph Smith's sincerity, while also emphasizing that finally such questions, at least in my mind, are really irrelevant when seen against Mormonism's development as a religion that prospered long after the death of its founder. So considering Mormonism's beginnings was a preface for engaging the fuller scope of the Latter-day Saint tradition. While elements of doctrines and covenants are easily accessible to students within the context of Mormonism's founding, the Book of Mormon, at least I found, is less amenable to immediate discussion. So to introduce students to the distinctive style of the text, I assigned the first book of Nephi after I contextualized it by outlining the entire narrative of the Book of Mormon itself. In the first book of Nephi, students do get a sense of some of the specific symbols in Mormonism, such as the sword of Laban and the rod of iron, as well as you can see certain Mormon doctrines in embryo, such as blood atonement and exaltation. But probing the fullness of the Book of Mormon as a whole is something that I have not been able to accomplish, really, since students seem mystified not only by the text appeal, but also by its content. And so I'm eagerly anticipating using Jana's book in this effort. I've had greater success, at least from my perspective, in teaching Mormon doctrine. In this effort, I've chosen Introduction to Mormonism by an English academic named Douglas Davies. And this has been the textbook that I use most often. Davies' work has almost the unique virtue of taking Mormonism seriously as a religion, and his discussions of the ethical implications of agency and exaltation are particularly complex and interesting. But the virtue of work can sometimes be an impediment, at least in the environment which I teach. Some students simply find Davies' book too advanced, and in any case, the rather truncated unit I dedicate to Mormonism, only 4 weeks in total, it becomes difficult to do the work any justice. And so I've been recently using Mormonism for Dummies, again, Jana's work, that quite helpfully compares LDS and contrasts LDS doctrine to that held in Protestant and Catholic variants of Christianity. The text's sense of humor also suggests that being Mormon can involve something more than straight-laced conformity and simplistic regurgitation of key doctrinal points. And just as a sidelight also, I had students review the recent documentary Mormons, and those reviews were published very graciously by Sunstone Magazine. And so what I try to do then is to have students engage portrayals of Mormonism in the broader culture. And so to expand on challenging Mormon stereotypes, I conclude the course with a contemporary work of Mormon fiction, Brother Brigham by D. Michael Martindale. Brother Brigham is a supernatural thriller that involves a demon masquerading as the spirit of Brigham Young. The demon, known as Legion, prophesies that the protagonist, one C.H. Young, who's nicknamed Cain, will become prophet, seer, and revelator of the LDS Church and restore the practice of plural marriage. And so what follows is a taking of plural wives and a good deal of nudity, perhaps reflecting Martindale's own quite public stance in favor of nudism, or what he describes as Mormon naturalism. And I think there's an article in the recent issue of Sunstone about this. We don't get into that, though. The novel is a quite orthodox ending, however, with the demon being expelled by the local bishop. And given Mormon's G-rated reputation, the novel does come as quite of a shock for most students. But in that lies its pedagogical value, for it shows that Mormonism is not just a religion or a cult, quote-unquote, but a culture that is diverse and is not easily reducible to stereotypes and caricatures. In round two of teaching Mormonism at a Jesuit institution, I tried to respond to the challenges my students and I face during round one. But it's become manifestly clear to me that both round one and round two were limited by the constraints of teaching Mormonism as a single unit within a larger course. So I'm now planning to abandon this approach entirely and teach Mormonism in a course devoted exclusively to it. And so I'll be able to expand the discussion of Mormon history, particularly by discussing the career of Brigham Young, as well as those of more modern presidents, such as David McKay. Students will also be able to explore the Book of Mormon more fully, hopefully with Jana's book and the help of Terrell Givens' commentary. And I also plan to devote greater attention to the development of Mormon theology, since I've heard Brian talk about this a number of times. I'm really inspired to do this. And I'm particularly interested in the intersections in Mormon theology with postmodern developments in Protestant and Catholic theology, and especially specific similarities with what could be called process theology. And so if Mormonism has truly moved from its cul-de-sac in American studies, I would argue in conclusion, then it's certainly time to see it as a religion that has something of intellectual content to say about the world and our place in it. Thank you.
Thanks to the uncharacteristic self-restraint of these academics, all of whom stayed within the allotted time limit, we have some time left. I don't want to cheat on any of that, so I'll ask only one question. Did everyone get a copy of the DVD? Okay, well, those are yet to be given out then. You only have 10? Okay.
If you're serious about teaching it, please take one.
And this DVD covers all of the back issues of Dialogue, digitized, readable, and all that, machine readable, up through 2005 issues. So you've got 2006, 7, and 8 that are not covered by that, but still very helpful. I used that DVD extensively in my own teaching. I just use it as a textbook. You give it out to the students, and then you don't have to worry about their finding the article in the library or anything. So it's just really helpful. Well, it's time for your questions and observations. Please use this mic that's set up here in the front. Since otherwise, your words disappear into the ether somewhere.
I really appreciate the observations that you all made. I was just wondering, in your syllabi, whether or not you include any of the schism groups, any of the splitter groups, as you might call them, in your discussions. Do you do any literary surveys of what's available out there? I'm just curious. And I have an ulterior motive to ask the first question, so I can get a comment.
Oh, well, it worked.
Incidentally, I teach at Grayson University.
Oh, thank you. Did everybody hear the question in the back? Is the mic working?
Yes.
Okay. Would some of you like to respond to this?
Sure. Are we passing it?
We do have it to pass, don't we?
I think it's here somewhere.
Oh, well, it doesn't go very far. The first couple of you. Yeah,
I feel like Dr. Phil.
Seems to be the...
How do you feel? Yes, for the schismatic groups, we did not devote a week to that. We didn't in the seminar. We didn't have a week devoted to that, but we did talk about it quite a bit. And actually, the students in the seminar had already dealt with Mormonism to a pretty good extent in the introductory course in American religion, and so they were familiar with that as well. And we had one paper that came out of it. So, it was dealt with, but I think we could have done more. We can always do more.
Because I live in Arizona and the polygamist, Warren Jeffs is in jail in Arizona, I always talk about it when I teach Mormonism. And the texts always do, too, or at least Terrell Givens does, and
I can't remember if Dave says or not. I've used his text too a couple of his texts. But when I teach the New Religious Movements course, I do devote a week to polygamous groups. I start with Mormonism as a bridge between the 19th and 20th centuries, and then later in the semester, so as to distinguish the two, you know, I do devote. And the text does that. The text that I use does that, devotes a chapter to, you know, polygamous groups. So that works.
One rather unfortunate reality, I think, is that when we ask about schismatic groups, we almost automatically are assuming we're talking about polygamous groups.
That's true.
And you know, the problem is that over the historical process, there are a lot of schismatic groups, some of which are very important historically. Was there another question?
I felt for a long time that there should have been more scholarly work done on Mormonism by major universities, and I felt that it should have started up here at the University of Utah. That's where it ought to be, and they have consciously chosen not to get involved in that at all. I don't know why, but I ask the question. You're going to be getting down to Claremont. You're going to be getting some regional research, I presume, in your graduate school.
Oh, sure.
And on these undergraduate level community colleges, you're going to be teaching stuff that they don't find in institutes, I presume, also. Is there going to be a conflict perceived by the church? And is the church, the leadership administration, going to react to some of this? Do you anticipate any problems like that? We've had some experience with such stuff.
Well, if you will permit me, I have some observations about that. The University of Utah situation is unusual because it's so politically riven and has been for a long time, with this bifurcation in which neither side is going to let the other side get away with anything. That's a situation, as I say, kind of unique to the University of Utah. I know from personal information, and I don't think it's secret, it's just not public, that both the Utah State University program, based on the Arrington Chair, and the Claremont program, based on the Hunter Chair, received significant tacit support from the general authorities of the church. Not financial support, I hasten to add, not a penny of financial support, but various kinds of encouragement, making contacts that would be helpful to warm up some other potential donors. And we have, to promote the Claremont program, we have a 10-minute little DVD that we hand out and show when we have gatherings of potential donors, promoting the Claremont as an institution and the School of Religion and Mormon Studies in particular. The concluding speaker on that Claremont DVD that ends with an appeal for support is Jeffrey Holland. So I think it's remarkable that we are beginning to see among some of the general authorities a level of support for academic Mormon studies ranging from tacit to kind of behind the scenes fairly strong support. So I don't see a rivalry there, but I do see a potential rivalry with CES, which would be another subject.
A couple of thoughts. When Eugene England first came over to Utah Valley State College and began to develop the Mormon studies efforts there, we hosted a panel discussion as part of his first conference that he hosted, and both Gene and I were on that panel, and inevitably the question came to us, have the general authorities approved of what you're doing down here? And I proceeded to try to clarify for the audience the importance of understanding that this was an academic enterprise and that the study of Mormonism would be academic in nature, just as if one would be studying politics or economics or the Jewish tradition or any other tradition, that it had to be this kind of effort at a state college. But of course, that's the explicit academic response. Tacitly and implicitly and politically, it's much more complex, even at a state college like Utah Valley and the University of Utah, as Armand has mentioned. The second thought is that I think it's important to note that the church is on the record as being in support of Mormon studies at institutions outside of BYU, another church-approved institutions. There are two newsroom commentary releases that explicitly support these efforts, and one of these mentions both Utah State and Claremont by name, and then the second release just a couple of months ago lists a number of universities that offer Mormon studies classes, which includes those two, of course, and Utah Valley and the University of North Carolina, and among others. There. And so that's also important to keep in mind when we think about this question of implicit or explicit support for the secular academic study of Mormonism.
Yeah. And it should be obvious that any kind of explicit support would be the kiss of death for an academic Mormon studies program. The last thing you want is for a public, imprimatur from the church. Next question. Alphonse and Gaston, okay.
Speaking of the University of Utah, that's my cue. I co-taught a course, a Mormon studies course, for 10 years with Bella Evans at the University of Utah. From 1988 to 98, Bella Evans taught women in Mormon culture, and during that time I was in the Women's Studies program and was her TA, and she had been trying to develop that course in the early 80s and trying to teach it a little bit, but she felt very alone, and I was trying to do Women's Studies and Mormon Studies and felt very alone, and she and I connected and were thrilled, and we developed that course together and co-taught it for 10 years. She had to sneak it in as a diversity course, and the whole time that she taught it, she was under siege from the church, but Mormon administrators at the University of Utah, who would bring pressure to bear on her to cease the course. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my book, Women in Authority, was developed in the program as a course text mm-hmm. for use in that course. It was an academic text, which the Brethren completely mistook as an act of personal dissent.
I see.
It was just a fascinating discussion of its own. But eventually, during the last few years of that 10-year period, Bella became tired of fighting the battles, became ill, and I wound up doing more and more of the teaching and grading in that class and her other classes. But that class, eventually, when she quit, she felt beaten. And we haven't brought the class back. I'm hoping to bring the class back. I'm trying to work on two master's degrees at the same time, but I hope to bring that class back fairly soon if I can. It was a wonderful course, and the other course that I know about, of course, was David Knowlton's Anthropology of Mormonism, which he taught at the University of Utah in the late 90s. But other than those two courses, those are the only two I know about at the University of Utah, other than the one you told me about, Armin, from the 70s, I think. Anyway, the point I was going to make, along with those points, is that what I found fascinating in the classroom, working with students who are engaging Mormonism in an academic environment in Salt Lake City, was not so much that the Mormon students felt intimidated by the non-Mormon students or that we were engaging Mormonism. It was a tremendously popular class. It was packed. We taught it once a year, and we had to let everybody in. We felt like we didn't want to turn anybody away, so sometimes we were dealing with 40 students instead of the usual 12 or 15 or 20. It was a huge hugely popular. There were complaints that we only taught it once a year, and there were complaints when the course went away. The conflicts that arose in the class were between the liberal Mormons and the conservative Mormons. Having that tension, which was interesting.
Well, that is. Thanks for those observations, Maxine. Appreciate it. Unless there's a response to that from any of you, I'll come ahead.
As some of you have received phone calls saying, well, why are we doing this with our religion? I'm wondering if there have been some other movements for lesser-known faiths to have isolated courses at universities or colleges around the country, or even well-known faiths having isolated classes outside of an entire religious studies department crop up. And, you know, that's something I'd like to see as well. So any news you have on that would be good.
Just very quickly, in the genesis of trying to develop Mormon studies courses during the same year that I mentioned before, the first year with Gene England there, we received an email from one of our colleagues who apparently was a conservative member of the church, and one of his questions to us was, how would you feel if your religion was put under a microscope by academics? And of course, that was the opportunity for us to respond, you know, by saying that academics is about putting the microscope on all kinds of different things. My second comment, though, is that in universities and colleges, normally curriculum development is grassroots, right? It's developed, or in its ideal form, it's developed at the level, at the faculty level, by professors who are interested in the field, or it's tied to student demand, or some other dynamic, and so it's going to be piecemeal, I think, not just with Mormon studies, but with new religious movements and other kinds of cult studies as time goes on. Academics is notoriously anarchistic.
You know, to me, thanks, Brian. To me, the parallel right now is what's going on with Muslim studies in America. And numerically, actually, it's kind of interesting what a parallel track Mormonism is on with Islam in America, not Islam around the world, but numerically here. And the drive to get Islamic studies and Muslim professors in American universities has been really fascinating. And also, of course, the drive to get funding for those professors and possibly even endowed chairs. So it'll be interesting to see how that parallel track continues.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, at Claremont, of all of those possible chairs that I mentioned in the Claremont model that might be endowed, so far only the Muslims and the Mormons have endowed chairs. None of the other religious communities has come anywhere near yet endowing a chair. And the Mormons and Muslims there talk about this from time to time, and we pretty much decided that the main reason is that when you're at the bottom of the heap in public opinion, you try harder. There is this kind of sense, I think, among the Mormon and the Muslim academics that they share a common predicament, and we, you know, we're very supportive of each other and each other's efforts, especially.
This is a little bit off topic, but I just thought I'd interject this. When I was entered medical school at the University of Utah in 1972, I took an institute course called Problems in Church History, in which we were introduced to a lot of the different things and sent to the Tanners, a bookstore to buy books and so forth for that course.
Uh-huh. Who was the professor, the teacher, remember? Yeah.
Okay. It was at the Institute up here.
Yeah, Benyon was gone by then, I think.
Yeah, it was Benyon.
I've got two questions. I've been a deer hunter in the past, and I don't know how you got your name Doe.
We
didn't have horns, but the deer without horns is called a doe. One with horns is a buck. We weren't supposed to shoot at the does.
Oh, hallelujah.
And, Jan, I got a question on why you selected a book by Toscanos. I think they got cut off at the church.
Okay. I think I better stand at the podium for this and have more authority. First of all, in my recollection, that's not a primary text but a supplementary text. Is that correct? I don't think that was a primary text. Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I think someone here has already mentioned, I think it was Matt, you know, how important it is to have the wide breadth of diversity of thought. Mormonism is far from monolithic, and I want my students to understand some of the controversies that exist, some of the tremendous differences of opinion that exist, the richness of the heritage, and the fact that Mormons do not all think the same. Now, obviously, that's going to involve citing sources that are sources that very Orthodox Mormons might feel uncomfortable with. In fact, maybe that's why that medical student just disappeared. I don't know, but to me, the importance is in the academic discussion and also teaching my students how to think critically.
I think it must be emphasized, too, that the kinds of courses we're talking about up here are not promotions of Mormonism. They're explorations of Mormonism. So there's no reason to avoid excommunicants like Brody or even more recent excommunicants in their literature. Some of you may be aware that one of the most important publications in contemporary Mormon studies is the Journal of Mormon History, which has been edited by an excommunicant for the past 10 years and done with great expertise. As I think Jana said it all. We're out of time, and it looks like we're out of questioners. So it worked out just right. Thanks to all of you for coming.